From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with David Windsor. This morning, we speak with licensed clinical social worker and parenting expert, Dr. Catherine Perlman, who speaks directly to 8 to 12-year-old children and their parents about digital safety in a manner that's playful, engaging, and age-appropriate. She highlights her book on the topic, First Phone, A Child's Guide to Digital Responsibility, Safety, and Etiquette. Then nurse and childbirth educator Lauren Davis, who coordinates the new childbirth education classes at Intermountain Park City Hospital. She joins us to discuss this new program. The next class, by the way, starts in January. It helps moms to be prepared for labor and delivery, and, well, dads and other partners as well. Finally, wondering how to make your kids resilient? Christina Hillsberg is a former CIA spy and analyst turned stay-at-home mom. She'll tell you how to help your kids make their own way in the world using spy tactics, real spy tactics. Her new book is Licensed to Parent, How My Career as a Spy Helped Me Raise Resourceful, Self-Sufficient Kids. All this coming up this hour on The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Research shows that 96% of children under 4 have used a mobile device, most before their first birthday. With digital technology and smartphones so ubiquitous, it is nearly impossible for parents to monitor and protect their children at every turn. Joining me now is licensed clinical social worker and parenting expert Catherine Perlman, PhD, who has been working with children and families for over 25 years and who joins us to discuss her new book, First Phone, A Child's Guide to Digital Responsibility, Safety, and Etiquette. Catherine, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's see. You and I, we know we didn't grow up with smartphones. We didn't grow up with cell phones at all. We got them as adults. And so now when we have children, it's a whole new world to navigate. There are many things that we don't even think about telling our kids. I assume this is why you wrote the book.
Yeah, you know, I think that there are there's some books about technology for parents, but then it leaves them to implement, which is hard because, as you say, we didn't grow up with this technology. Kids are often one step ahead of us. And I had gotten a lot of calls from parents who tell me, oops, my child got into something. You know, as you say, kids are getting their phones and access to iPads so early these days, and they're getting into things that they have no idea how to handle. And they're getting bombarded with news and scams and things like that. And their parents are not always around. So I wanted this book to be a guide for kids. So when their parents aren't around, they can make good decisions for themselves.
And this book is First Phone. I feel like when I read through it, it's targeted at kids, but it feels like a book that you read together with your child.
Yeah, you know, I wanted it to be written so it was a language that kids understand. I created these 5 kids so it would be a fun read and it would be kid to kid. But I also wanted a guide for parents because this is just the beginning. You know, this book isn't the end all be all. You're not going to get your kid the phone and give them the talk and then be done with it. Digital education is really a lifetime. So I wanted parents to begin this conversation and then be able to keep it going.
How often do you see kids that are 5 through 10 who already have cell phones?
The average age of kids getting a phone is really somewhere between 8 and 11 these days. There are some good reasons for a younger kid, 8 or 9, to get a phone. Maybe they have a divorced family. Maybe they have a medical issue. But I think in general, you know, 5, 6, 7 is a little too young to have your own digital device.
Okay. And what are those considerations in having parents allow children to have a phone? Everyone seems to use the excuse that I just want to know where they are and I want them to be able to call home. But you and I grew up without our parents having that luxury. Is it really necessary to know where our kids are all the time or to be able to contact them all the time?
No, it's absolutely not necessary, but it is sort of the environment that we're in now. It is sort of the expectation. And I think parents are struggling to give their kids some freedoms that we had as kids, you know, some independence. And I actually think if it makes a parent more comfortable to be able to contact their kid, and that allows them to let them walk home from school, which, you know, kids were doing in late elementary school years ago, and now some parents are concerned about letting high schoolers walk home by themselves. So I do think that there is some level of peace of mind it gives parents. But, you know, getting a smartphone doesn't mean you get all the bells and whistles. You know, maybe as you're a younger child, you're just getting the ability to text and call your parents, but you're not getting apps and the internet. And, you know, as you develop skills and as you get older, maybe you get more of those things.
So what are those sorts of filters that parents need to have on a phone, or what is, you know, how easy is it to just go to the phone store, the Verizon store, wherever, and say, okay, this is my child's first phone. These are the controls that I need on it. These are the functions that I need, and these are the functions that I don't need. I feel like I wouldn't even know, even though I've had a smartphone for, you know, quite some over a decade, how to do that, what to say.
So I think that, you can get some assistance from your phone company. You absolutely can go into any of the stores and say, I'm a parent, I'd like some protections. iPhone and Android also have these great settings on the phones. But the truth of the matter is, even with all of that, with the best protection, if you're the most tech savvy parent, your kid's friend maybe doesn't have those protections. The older sibling doesn't have those protections. And your kid is going to have access. So we have to teach kids how to be smart about what they Google and click on, no matter what, how well we protect their phone. And I do think that there are some limitations and settings that are really helpful in terms of managing screen time, not just necessarily protecting kids against the dangers of the internet, but maybe setting it so there's no more than an hour a day of social media or the internet, or blocking the internet during homework hours, things like that.
If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Catherine Perlman, who has written the book, First Phone, A Child's Guide to Digital Responsibility, Safety, and Etiquette. Well, most of us as adults had to learn that, oh, when you Google, you know, the best night cream for my face, suddenly all these ads are popping up about the best night cream for your face. In the beginning, I think that we were so naive to it that we probably thought it was some strange coincidence. And now the strangest things happen. You know, you take a picture of your vacuum to go get a new hose for it, and then suddenly you have vacuum ads popping up. And this whole world is pretty strange and even dark. And so what do we say to our kids about that?
I think we talk about a digital footprint, which, you know, is something that kids need to start thinking about, the kind of ways that they're using the internet, but also about data and how data is collected on us about all the things that we do. And some of that is wonderful. Starbucks knows the drinks I want. They know when I'm in the area of a Starbucks. That is really helpful. You know, my music is played and I get the next song I never heard of, but I also like it. It knows what I like. Some of that is actually wonderful, but it does mean we need to be more mindful about what we click on, and understand how ads work, understand how influencers work, understand how data works. And I think kids from a very young age can begin this discussion. And much like we teach kids, you know, sex ed at a young age, a little at a time, I think digital education should really be going the same way. Kindergartners are being assigned iPads and computers for school, and we need to start talking to them about, what are you Googling? What are you clicking on? What are the ramifications? And they can begin to understand this.
And they're coming into this as digital natives. And so it seems to me that it's never too early to talk about this stuff. The same as talking to our kids about things like mental health and sex education and all of that drug use and alcohol use. And this just seems like another category that you're really shining the light on in a way that I haven't really seen. But I want to ask you about the illustrations in the book, which are so great and so appealing to kids, and how you came up with those.
So, you know, I wanted the book to look fun. I wanted kids to literally open it and say, this is something I might want to read. And actually, I know some parents who've literally just left it out on the coffee table, didn't say anything about it, and kids pick it up. I worked with an illustrator named Dave Coverley, who is wonderful. He has a sense of humor, and he really took, you know, my ideas and just created this wonderful world of these five kids, so that kids can actually relate to them. And I have to say, when I finished writing the book, I actually felt like those characters were real to me. I kind of missed them. Like I needed to put them to bed. So I think the illustrations add a lot to the book.
You've got Max and Benny, Maya, Sophia, and Jack. These are the personalities. And throughout the book, you have them quoting different things about their thoughts and their beliefs. So it's so accessible and readable. Even for very young kids, if you're reading this with your child. I want to tell you, Catherine, that two copies of this book arrived at the radio station. Two people on staff, before I even saw that the book was here, grabbed it because they have young kids. And after I told them, wait, I haven't done the interview yet. You need to return these books, but I promise you can go home with them. They were really excited about it. And it just seems so useful. Let's talk now about social media. What are the things that are most important to tell a child about social media?
So social media, just like everything with technology, there's some wonderful things that are happening on social media, but there are also some upsetting things that are happening. And what we know, and the research is definitely still evolving, but the more time kids spend on social media, the more negative effects such as anxiety, depression, and low self-esteem. And think about it, if you're a developing child, you're going through puberty, you know, your body is changing. And also teens are ripe to analyze themselves against all of their peers. And then you have this thing called social media where everybody looks good, everybody uses filters, they maybe take 100 pictures just to get this one where they look perfect. There are influencers selling things that makes it look like this is their real beliefs, but maybe they're just getting paid. It's a very confusing environment for a young person. On the other hand, this is really where teenagers are communicating. They're not texting each other. They are messaging within apps. And so it is how they're socializing. And now some schools are requiring kids to be in social media to have a chat room with their class and getting assignments, or maybe a coach is assigning kids to be part of this so they can just disseminate information really quickly. So we can't just bury our heads in the sand. We do have to talk about how to go on social media, how to moderate, how to make sure you're not just spending all your time there. And also talk about, you know, how do we recognize if we need to take a break, and telling kids it's okay to unfollow somebody. It's okay to hide somebody. If an account is triggering you, get rid of it. If you're spending too much time on an app, maybe take it off your phone, or maybe limit the hours you can use it. There are ways that we can help moderate this effect.
Teaching kids self-moderation, it would seem to me, really helps in something else that these days we're talking about so much, because I think we coddle our kids these days more than in the past when we were sort of free-range kids, and that is about resilience. And it seems to me that teaching kids about how to put up their own boundaries with social media will help with that resilience. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, we need to give our kids personal agency. The best solutions are the ones that come from the kids. And, you know, parents, I think, are protecting their kids to such an extent that they're not getting enough chance to do the independent living skills so that they're ready to face the world. You know, they're getting their driver's license later, they're dating later, they're not socializing with friends as much as they used to. And so we have to start giving kids the skills and the digital skills to sort of manage their lives. I recently had an issue with my son, and rather than telling him what to do, I said, here's what I see as the problem. What do you think? He said, I agree with the problem. I said, well, what do you think the solution is? He came up with a perfectly good solution that he is able to follow, rather than me coming up with a solution. And now I'm nagging him, and there's no connection, and there's no way he's going to, you know, follow that problem and solution when he goes off to college. So we have to start giving our kids more of a say in the way they manage their technology.
So then if we were to have kids recognize which hours of the day would be the best ones to turn off our phone or put it in another room. You know, we all know that for our circadian rhythm and for our sleep, don't look at screens for an hour, whatever it is, before you go to bed. But it seems to me that there are other times of day really important not to look at social media. What do you say about that?
I think, you know, right before class, right before you're studying, right before you're doing homework, because, you know, it riles us up. We see something and then all of a sudden we're just like, you know, in a heightened state. We might feel anxious or we might feel angry. But, you know, interestingly enough, we know what we know about sleep, and yet probably 80% of kids are sleeping with their phones. one in three kids wakes up in the night, sometimes setting an alarm so that they can follow up on messages and check in on their phones. 30% sleep with their phone on their pillows. So we know these things, and yet we're not allowing our kids to have a social break. We're not allowing them to have a good night's sleep. We're kind of just giving in. And this is, if I give one advice to parents, this is a really important one. Keep the phones out of the bedroom at night.
Yes, I was going to ask about that. And how, what percentage of parents are doing this right now?
Unfortunately, not many, because I think some parents try and they get a lot of pushback, which is normal. And they just give in. It feels like this mountain they can't climb, or it feels like inevitable, and they just do it. And not only that, a lot of parents are sleeping with their phones too. And so it's kind of like, they think, what's the big deal? But I think what, you know, there is some research that's evolving about phones and kids. But what we know from extensive amount of research is kids are not getting enough sleep. And when they're not getting enough sleep, it affects their grades, their memory, their ability to cope, their depression, anxiety. And in the last decade, anxiety and depression in kids has skyrocketed. So I think it's a matter of like educating parents, let them know that there actually are some pretty severe side effects. Nothing good is happening with your kids in the middle of the night. It's important to buy them an alarm clock and keep the phone out of the room.
Absolutely. That probably goes for us too. I was thinking about myself, and yes, I keep my phone right there, and it's not to check social media or anything like that, but it's about my alarm. It's about my Calm app for when I do wake up in the middle of the night. And yeah, maybe just getting away. It's so funny in your book, while it's so simplistic and accessible and readable for young people, so many of these things, as I said in the beginning, we didn't grow up with smartphones. And so we need to learn these lessons as well. So good job on the book.
Thank you so much.
The book is First Phone, A Child's Guide to Digital Responsibility, Safety, and Etiquette. My guest is Catherine Perlman. Catherine, do you have anywhere else that you can be found?
Sure. Folks can find me at thefamilycoach.com.
Thefamilycoach.com. All right. Catherine, thank you so much for joining me on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Lauren Davis is a nurse and childbirth education coordinator at Intermountain Park City Hospital and has been a nurse there for 4 years. She's the new childbirth education coordinator. Originally from Indiana, she's been a nurse for 18 years, first working in ICUs and then in labor and delivery for the past 10 years. Well, Lauren, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
So first, we want to mention that there is a class taking place now, but there are rolling schedules of a 6-week course. Is that how it works?
It's a 2-hour class, a 6-week session. So in Park City, it's every Wednesday in the Blair Education Center, which is just in the hospital, from 6 to 8 p.m., running weekly for 6 weeks. And sign up online at intermountainhealthcare.org.
Okay. And there are online offerings as well. This obviously is a part of childbirth education. I guess I always think of the, you know, classes where you sit around and learn how to breathe and those sorts of things. But the newborn realm is equally something that we really need plenty of education on. Many parents-to-be have never been around a newborn.
I remember the first time I taught the newborn care class, and I was like, well, we're going to go over how to change a diaper. And I thought, this is dumb. Everybody knows how to change a diaper. Nobody knew what they were doing. I was like, okay, this is a really important part of this course. So yeah, even just learning just the very basic newborn care stuff is really important for moms and dads alike.
We can all laugh about those types of things that we all did as young parents, first-time parents. I remember we had this, you know, cloth diaper service, and they brought us 90 diapers for the week, and we went through 90 diapers in about 36 hours, because every time there was just the tiniest amount of moisture. We have to change the baby. And yeah, you're right that, you know, never skip over the basics, because even if we think we know, maybe we learned incorrectly, or maybe just in the throes of new parenthood, everything that we thought we knew goes out the window. Is that kind of how it works?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think you can never underestimate the lack of knowledge that you have as a new parent. Yeah. So this class really helps you prepare for that. And not only the newborn basic care, but we do go over, you don't get certified, but we do go over really important things like basic infant CPR and choking. So, you know, God forbid you had a situation, like a very serious situation, you would just be totally, I have no idea what to do. You would have a little bit of basic knowledge of like the first steps you would need to take in an emergency like that. We have somebody come in from the health department and go over some really important stuff about car seats too. Every time I hear her speak, I'm like, I learned something new, because there's just so much to know about car seats, and there's so many out there now. So yeah, it's just really a wealth of knowledge. I mean, every single class has such great information about every single step of the process of birth and labor and being a new parent.
I've been to a lot of barbecues with new moms and families and parents, and there's always, everyone becomes an expert once they've, and everyone has their opinion about how it can be done and what could be done better, what they should do, and everyone's just forcing their opinion on individuals that are about to go through this process. Is there a point where there's too much information, and how can women filter this type of stuff out?
Absolutely. And I think another favorite thing for people to do just at like a barbecue or something like you're saying is to share their horror stories. So like the absolute worst possible scenario, or the worst part of their experience, or their neighbor's experience, or their sister's experience. So I think that's another just great reason why coming to like a formal education class can be so important, because it does, we're not there to scare you or tell you worst possible scenarios. You know, we want to give you all of the information of, you know, what the normal path is, and then the different variations of what you may come into contact with during your process. So you just kind of know all of the different things that you could expect. You're super informed going into the process so that you can like make better decisions for yourself and be a better self-advocate, be really empowered about your own care.
What about dads? What I know there's a lot of, you know, obviously this is a journey that women take by themselves for the most part. I mean, we can only experience so much from a male perspective. And so how can dads and new fathers help join the process and make it easier for their wives?
I think the biggest thing is come to the classes with them, because then you're getting all the information. You're also empowering yourself with knowledge about the process. And a big part of our class is teaching dads, or whoever you choose to be your birth partner, whoever that may be for you, the best way to support you during the labor. But not only that, we also teach how to help support you during your postpartum time and take care of that brand new baby. And that's a really new thing for a lot of, you know, basically everybody in a prenatal ed class is our first time parents.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Lauren Davis. She's a nurse and a childbirth education coordinator at Intermountain Park City Hospital. And Lauren, as you're talking, it also reminds me that things change. You know, this age-old knowledge that we may think we possess, or our mothers and grandmothers possessed about how to handle your baby, things change. And you brought up the car seat. When I was young, I don't even think that I ever had a car seat as a baby, but, you know, in those times. And also now, things like when I had kids, you were supposed to lay them on your stomach, and I think now the baby's supposed to be on the back. Can you talk about something like that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely another really great point about these classes. It's all based on evidence-based practice, so which is ever-changing when it comes to labor and delivery and newborn care. And it's really important because it's all based on research of what's the safest for you and your baby. So definitely things have changed. Like you said, the tummy time and sleeping on the tummy was like a huge thing. I know when I was an infant, And now it's absolutely the opposite. You know, back is best. You don't want anything in the crib. And I know, you know, back in the day it was all about, oh, the ruffles and the crib bumpers and all the things. Yeah. So you can't always rely on what grandma and mom are telling you, because things do change, and we'll keep you up to date on the safest ways in the prenatal classes.
You talk about the lack of knowledge, and I'm sure there's a lot of individuals coming in scared, and you can only prepare for so much in an environment and an opportunity like this to become a new parent. And so what are some of the biggest misconceptions or concerns that people come in with that really aren't the reality of what they're going to go through?
I think there's a lot. I think one of the biggest ones is my water breaks and my baby's going to fall out of my body. I have to rush in. Now, that can be true if it's your third, fourth, even second baby. But the first time, you know, you have some time, you can slow down. I think people think it's, you know, are really afraid of the pain of it all. And I think our culture and our society has really driven that home for women, that our bodies maybe aren't prepared to do this, and that they weren't made to do this. And it's just scary and painful. And that is where these classes are so key and crucial to help you understand that this is all normal. It's a natural process. Our bodies are made to do this, and giving you all the coping techniques to help you through that. And so, you know, you come in knowing your options of how to better cope with your biggest fears, like pain being the number one thing.
So once you've faced those fears, you've experienced them, and you've gone through that natural process of bringing a life into the world, the second time around, third time around, are there still the concerns and worries, or do people feel like they've mastered it now per se, and they're ready to take it on themselves?
I think it kind of depends on the person and your previous experience, for sure. If you think of your previous birth as traumatic, it might be worse for you. But I think what is better about the second, third times around is there isn't the unknown mm-hmm. of what it's going to feel like and look like what the environment's going to be like. So you taking that out of the equation, I think for me and for a lot of other women, is a huge part in decreasing the fears.
It's interesting, the whole relationship with pain and looking at pain as this, it's productive pain. But if you let your mind get carried away, the pain can become insurmountable, right? And so, sure. Again, the childbirth education classes are specifically designed to sort of combat that and to make you feel friendly with your pain, or know that it's, you know, it's just part of the process and you can control it kind of with your mind. Do we find right. with current research on, you know, sort of the power of the brain, does that really change childbirth education?
I don't necessarily know that it changes it, but I think having a knowledge base that this pain is normal and actually required, a required part of the process to progress in labor, can help you kind of change that mindset about pain. I mean, I think we in our culture are so hardwired that pain is bad. Pain equals bad. And I think that's another really hard thing for when dads or partners come in, is like, you see, you know, you're the mother of your child and all this pain, and you feel so helpless and out of control. And that's a great thing. I the classes teach not only the woman that's going to be going through the process, like how to cope with this pain, how it's a normal part of the process, why you're experiencing it, but also kind of helps like the partner understand it's okay. You know, when you come in and you're writhing in pain from these contractions, and the nurses are just kind of like, breathe, you're going to be fine. We're not concerned, because we know this is a normal part of the process. So, you know, being familiar with understanding pain as part of that process is helpful for people. And I don't think that's something that people understand. They're just right off the bat afraid of it.
Mm-hmm. I was at a dinner last night and some friends have a little 6-month-old baby, and we were talking about during labor and delivery, you know, I think you see this on sitcoms and things like that, where the pregnant woman in labor and delivery is their husband or partner is saying something completely wrong. And then she yells at them and she says, "This is all your fault," you know, on and on, and asking them, you know, did they have any of that in their labor and delivery? And they said no. And we all decided that's just something that you see in the movies. That's not a reality. but of course, childbirth education is meant to help you not have that happen. But can you comment on those sorts of things that you've seen in your experience?
Absolutely. I think the number one rule that you learn working in the field for a while that is helpful to remind partners is you need to practice a lot of forgiveness during this process. You may say things that you don't mean, or maybe not be quite yourself during the labor and delivery process. And that's normal. We see that all the time, all the time. And there is literally nothing.
So it's not just a sitcom.
It is not. It's not everybody, that's for sure. But don't feel ashamed if you're letting some words fly out of your mouth, maybe that you wouldn't normally say, or, you know, acting in a maybe less than savory way, you know, in the heat of labor. It's okay. We forgive you. We're not going to hold it against you. And neither should your partner.
I love that. I have a friend who's a firefighter, and he says a lot of maybe the biggest phone calls they get are individuals who decided to do at-home births, natural births, and then halfway through the process, they start panicking and freaking out, and the experience isn't what they thought it was going to be, and they called 911. Yeah. And so half, if not most, of their service calls are to help individuals that thought they were going to take this on themselves, and now they need help from a professional. And so what would you encourage young mothers or parents that want to take this process on, and how can they make sure that it's the right environment for them that they can do it correctly?
I think being informed of what exactly home birth entails, what your resources are going to be if you do run into a situation at home, and how you're going to handle that, and just be prepared for that. I understand women who want to do a home birth. I totally get wanting to be in your own familiar surroundings. But you know, you are kind of doing that at the expense of having, you know, a hospital resources right at the tips of your fingers, you know, in the event of an emergency. But I also think that it helps to know that literally every woman gets to that point where I can't do this. Panicking, and it's a normal part of what we call a transitioning part of labor. It's towards the end, you're done, you're scared, you're having intense pain, and it's normal. So, you know, also informing yourself of all the normal emotions and progression of that labor process, especially if you're going unmedicated, meaning not using anything other than like co-mechanisms for pain control. You know, you will probably reach a point where, yeah, you are gonna panic and think, I can't do this. I need to go somewhere. Somebody needs to get this baby out of me. And that's normal. So if you kind of can go into it being informed of the normal emotions and then the process you would take in the event of an emergency, I think that's your best setup.
All right, Lauren. So what about the dates, the details of these education classes? Where can people sign up? What was the process, the cost, all the above?
It's a 2-hour class, a 6-week session. So in Park City, it's every Wednesday in the Blair Education Center, which is just in the hospital, from 6 to 8 p.m., running weekly for 6 weeks. And sign up online at intermountainhealthcare.gov or .org, sorry. In the meantime, though, you can email me at pkhbirthclass@imail.org or call 435-658-7273, and you can register via email or over the phone. And it's a $90 class that includes a seat for you and your partner of choice, whoever that may be for you. A booklet with all the information that we're going to go over in class. And in that booklet, there is a QR code that gets you access to an app that's just super interactive and has lots of videos and information that you can access at any time.
Lauren, before we let you go, I wanted to ask about the timing of your pregnancy and taking a childbirth class. You don't want to take it too early because then you might forget everything, right? But you also don't want to take it too late because I think I was in a childbirth class with, we hadn't finished and someone, someone had, you know, had their baby before we got to the end of the class. Sure. So when is the best time?
I think ideally around that 28 week-ish mark, so like late second trimester. You can sign up at any time. I would say when you know you're pregnant, get signed up. Right now we are working on other dates, but very soon I will have more dates up for next year. Honestly though, if that time frame doesn't work for you at around the 28 week mark, anytime would be good. Because, you know, knowledge is power, and getting this knowledge at any time during your pregnancy is going to be a good thing.
And do the classes ever fill up? I know the Blair Education Center can be quite large, big room.
Prior to COVID, yes. So this is the first in-person classes we've had since COVID. So I think there's going to be a little bit of a time where people are figuring out that they're up and running again, and hopefully all this marketing that we're doing with you and KUTV will help. But eventually, yes, they do fill up. So I would say as soon as you know you're pregnant, get on and get signed up so you know you have a spot reserved.
Obviously, our whole world since COVID revolves around being online. I know you can do online childbirth classes as well. How do you do that?
Sure. So yes, we do offer online childbirth classes. We have a couple for platforms. So there's a live virtual options, and then also just a strictly online class that's powered by Yomingo. And you can get signed up for those through intermountainhealthcare.org.
But nothing like being in person and practicing your breathing with the whole rest of the group.
Exactly. And I think it's so important too to understand that you are going to be surrounded by women going through the same process, and dads are going to be surrounded, partners are going to be surrounded by other partners who are going through the new process as well. So I have a lot of classmates who become friends, and you know, it's the start of that support system.
Yep. Start of a great phase of life. Lauren Davis is a nurse and childbirth education coordinator at Intermountain Park City Hospital. We're so glad you could join us today, Lauren. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And again, for more information about childbirth classes, the next one begins in January. You can register for that by calling 435-658-7273 or email pkhbirthclass@imail.org, or you can register also at intermountainhealthcare.org. We will be back after these words. We'll be talking a little bit more about how to make your kids resilient when we return. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Well, since we've been talking this hour about parenting and everything that goes along with it, Dr. Catherine Perlman spoke in the beginning of the hour about resilience and how to teach your kids personal agency. And it made me think about an interview I did last year with former CIA spy Christina Hillsburg, who has written a book called Licensed to Parent. It was such a great interview, and we have a little extra time. I'm going to rebroadcast that interview. Won't be able to play the whole thing, but you can always go to kpcw.org under the Shows tab and The Mountain Life to hear those archive shows. We will post that show or that interview again today. Here's Christina. Please enjoy.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My guest is former spy turned stay-at-home mom, Christina Hillsburg. She provides a groundbreaking guide to parenting based on her experience as a CIA analyst. She's written a new book about it. It's called License to Parent: How My Career as a Spy Helped Me Raise Resourceful, Self-Sufficient Kids. Now, her unparalleled approach to child rearing provides both an inside look into one of the world's most clandestine organizations, but also it's a practical guide for how to utilize key spy tactics to teach kids important life skills. Christina Hillsburg, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the spy tactics and how they apply to parenting, which is just the most fabulous and commonsensical approach to parenting, I think, now that I've looked at it, I just have to hear a little bit about how you got into the CIA. The fact that you took on a love for Swahili and that got you into it is just so interesting.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it happened more out of happenstance than any sort of careful planning. I followed something I was very passionate about, which was linguistics and African studies. And I studied Swahili and Zulu at Indiana University. They have a fantastic African language program, and fell in love with the language, the politics, and I couldn't wait to travel to Africa. And I did as a student and studied abroad and doing a Swahili program. And I was recruited on campus by a CIA recruiter. I actually dodged the first interview. I had no idea what government agency it was, just thought it sounded rather boring. All I knew is they wanted foreign language speakers. And I thought, I don't think so. I went to a Ladysmith Black Mambazo concert instead, which, you know, I thought was a lot more fun. And it was fun. And the recruiter ended up staying an extra day to meet with me. And I thought, well, why not? Let me just go see what this is about. It'll be good interview practice, if anything. And he told me he was from the CIA and that the position would, you know, allow me to travel to Africa. I would analyze African politics and African leaders. I could use my foreign language skills. And I was taken. You know, I knew that it sounded like an incredible career. And it's funny because so many people are driven to work for the CIA out of a sense of patriotism for, you know, the US, or a desire to be like James Bond, which was my husband. But for me, it was my love for a foreign land, strangely enough. It was an opportunity to work and travel to Africa. And I relished in it and started a career and fell in love with it. And then, of course, fell in love with my husband.
Oh, I love it. You were recruited by the CIA. You spent several decades working as a spy. And as you say, you met your husband, Ryan, and he also was a spy, which there's a whole story in that. What's kind of fun about your book is it's part memoir, then it's part parenting guide, but with a twist. And so if, you know, the lay person were to think of traits that a spy would possess, I would think curiosity, heightened awareness, you know, no room for oblivion, right? And personal, a great sense of personal responsibility. But what are those characteristics and how are you taught them by your CIA training?
So we talk a lot in the book about a variety of skills, and they're from the more physical ones that we learn at the CIA to the softer skills. So you have, of course, things like how to spot and avoid danger, preparing for emergency scenarios, and then you have more of the other skills that you don't immediately think of, like writing, communication, persuasion, technology, those sorts of things. And so one of the ideas that we discuss in the book is that how to spot and avoid danger. And at the CIA, they call it get off the X. And the X can be anything. It can be a person, a place, an environment. And we learn in our training that you are to move away from the X as quickly as possible. The longer that you're on the X, the more unlikely it is that you will get out, you know, the more likely it is that you'll be harmed, I should say. And so we teach that same concept to our kids. I learned it early on in one of my first, we call them TDY assignments, temporary duty assignments to a country in sub-Saharan Africa, where I learned that I should treat every red stoplight as an X. I was not to stop at a red stoplight because smash and grabs and carjackings were very common there. And so I was to roll through them. Of course, this is not a practice that I endorse stateside, but that was an example of getting off the X, you know, not putting yourself in that dangerous situation. And so that is a concept that we have adapted to teach for our kids. And we provide takeaways of what that looks like for parents. And, you know, a lot of that is teaching your kids to listen to their gut, helping them visualize escape routes, emphasizing the urgency that they should respond to alarms and warning signals. You may be surprised to hear that, you know, so many of the survivors of 9/11 took time to delay their departure, sometimes up to 30 minutes, because they were, you know, shutting down their computers, changing their shoes. And so we want our kids to respond to something, even if they think it's a drill. You know, they don't have to storm out like George Costanza and Seinfeld and yell fire. You know, they can respond calmly, but with a sense of urgency. And we also talk to them about how it is sometimes appropriate to ignore authority figures, especially in an emergency scenario. We talk about the South Korean ferry boat disaster and how many of the kids who perished on that boat stayed in their rooms because that is what the voice over the intercom told them to do. We want our kids to think critically and realize that even in that situation, they cannot freeze. They need to get off the X, even if that means going against what the orders are.
If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, my guest is Christina Hillsburg. Her new book is License to Parent: How My Career as a Spy Helped Me Raise Resourceful, Self-Sufficient Kids. Christina, you know, we are at this age where it's become really a problem, an epidemic, where we do everything for our kids. We want our kids to achieve, and so we figure if we sign them up for things and if we help them out and tell them how to do everything and helicopter parent, then they're going to be more successful. And what we do is we end up making kids who aren't very resilient and who don't know something like getting off the X, and who certainly are a bit oblivious about the world around them. It's interesting, someone was saying to me the other day, and you know this because you traveled so extensively, is that travel in and of itself is a way to make kids a little more resilient and have that personal accountability. I'm wondering, you know, we all say to our kids when they leave, oh, you know, be careful out there. What should we be saying to our kids instead?
Well, I hope that everyone will start saying, remember to get off the X, because I know that's what we say to our kids when they leave the house. But it's funny you mentioned travel, because that is a great way to get kids to be more resilient and even more self-sufficient. One of the things that with my toddlers, when we've traveled, I actually make them carry their own luggage. I will not be carrying my kids through the airport. They will be walking and they will be carrying everything they want on that plane and on that trip on their back. So they better choose wisely. And so, I mean, I felt so proud of them to see a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old carrying their backpacks through the airport. That's a great example of, you know, giving your kids that responsibility and not just doing it for them. And sometimes I think it can be so easy, especially with little kids, to do it for them, especially in public, because we don't want to deal with the tantrum. We don't want to deal with, you know, the result of them not getting to do what they want to do. But I would just encourage parents to push through, because you're helping them in the end by giving them that responsibility. And even, you know, our oldest daughter, she's 18. She's been on an epic road trip the past 2 weeks because she graduated early and she has been driving all over from here. She actually went down through Utah and down through Southern California and all the way up, and she's doing it all by herself. And I'm so proud of her. And it is really this security awareness and all of these skills that she's been learning her whole life that has set her up to have the ability to do this and to do it on her own.
So this is a great question. And I just want to mention that when you married Ryan, he had 3 kids of his own. Since then, you've had 2 more, the 2- and 4-year-old, I assume.
That's right.
And so for the 18-year-old, this is big. You know, when we send our kids out, they've had driver's ed, which we know from the amount of people that drive in the left-hand lane, in the fast lane, going slow, that, you know, driver's ed doesn't do a lot for us. So how did you prepare her, for example, knowing how to change a tire, and what kinds of things does she have that she carry along with her in the car?
So she is equipped with the grown-up version of the adventure bag that we start with our toddlers, and it becomes an emergency go bag. So she, of course, has all of the necessary emergency tools in her vehicle. But I think one of the most important things that she has is the skill of being aware of her surroundings. And one of the ways that we talk about that in the book, we talk about CIA surveillance detection routes and the skills and training that we've learned at the CIA and the way that we've adapted it to our kids. One of those ways is through driving. And when our kids first get their permits and they first go behind the wheel, what Ryan first does is he takes them to an empty parking lot and they spend about 2 hours driving backwards. Not driving forwards, only backwards. And the idea is that You know, if you do that, if you can drive in reverse, well, then driving forward will be a lot easier. And there's a lot of backwards driving that goes on at the CIA, at the farm. Ryan will tell you that he was the best backwards driver. He's very proud of this. I am, on the other hand, the worst. And my four-year-old has already realized that and let me know that daddy needs to teach mommy some reverse skills. And so that's one of the things that we do, or that Ryan does rather, with the kids when they start driving, and also teaching them to merge. Like the very first time they're behind the wheel on that same day, he's taking them onto the interstate. You know, that's something that I didn't do for several driver's ed lessons, and it became this intimidating thing for me, and they go right in with him. And the idea behind this being that the better they are at driving and these capabilities, the more awareness they will have of what's going on around them. If they're so focused on their driving and not knowing how to reverse well and not being good at these other things, they can't see everything that's going on. They can't have good security awareness, good situational awareness. And so we're buckling down on those driving skills so that they have the ability to observe their surroundings.
Mm. Times have changed with the emergence of this little smartphone. You know, it used to be when I was young and I was doing the backpacking around and I would land in a new country or a new city, and it really maybe gave me so much confidence to figure out where I was, figure out which way, north, south, east, west, and just have that awareness of the layout of the new city or wherever it is. But we don't really have that anymore because our heads are stuck. All we have to do is pull up our Google Maps and it figures this out for us. How do we keep that, and how do we nurture that directional, you know, kind of awareness in our children?
Yeah, we want to expose our kids to those basic skills that we've lost for the exact reason you've said. We've relied on technology so much, and you know, the CIA can be very technologically advanced, but when it comes to clandestine operations, you know, a lot of times it's down to the basics, right? You have to consider, if you have a cell phone on you, that you could be tracked, you're going to meet an asset. And so there are various types of operational security things that you have to consider. And so you learn how to, you know, study a city, you know, the map beforehand, familiarize yourself.
And that was Christina Hillsburg. You can hear the entirety of that rebroadcast interview at kpcw.org under the Shows tab in The Mountain Life. Or you can also find it at KPCW The Mountain Life, anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in today. It's KPCW Park City.